Chatter on books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Hey, Chatter on Books, welcome back. Thank you for being with us. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Mark Leibovich, who I believe was the first ever author on Chatter on Books, who has really, literally, correct use of the word, the only political book I have read in years. I think his book, Thank You for Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission, can be called a political book, but it's spectacular. But in the meantime, speaking of spectacular, we of course have award-winning Claude Jennings doing the important work. We have David Aldridge sporting his AU gear. I'm sporting my Caps gear. And the one and only Gene McManus is back.
Yes. Hi.
No surprise visit. Yay. Gene, welcome back.
Thank you. Guest appearance. Happy to be here. So happy to see all your faces.
Wonderful. Yes. I told one of the crossovers, as I call them now, a long time little, who loves and reveres you from Tony Kornheiser days and loved and revered you on this show. When I told this person that you were going to be on, say, is she going to be on more than that? And I said, let's just take it one step at a time.
Well, it's so much homework that I have to do. I'd be on it more if I didn't have all this homework.
Or not so much. One time, I won't even tell you who the author is, but maybe next time I see you all in person, I have too much to drink. I would just talk to an author months after we had this person on the show. And something about, well, you know, we read the books and we care. And this person said, you know, I finished it. I never read the whole thing. Finished it. Editor, God bless them. Somebody who actually had an editor that I did not have, never read the book from start, never really sat down and said, okay, this is the book from start to finish. How about that?
How about that?
Was the book any good?
Yes. Yes.
Well, maybe there's something to that.
I think that speaks to the power of editors.
Maybe.
Yeah, which someday maybe I'll have one. Maybe. Gene McManus, okay, we want to catch up. I get to see you. You and I have met during the pandemic, since then, catch up and everything else. But others want to hear, how are you? How's the painting? What's going on?
I'm very well as anybody could be in the midst of this still ongoing pandemic. Painting is great. I've been taking courses online, which are actually wonderful, because my painting teachers almost instantly got very adept at technology, at Zoom technology, at PowerPoint presentations, about using pointers to point out things that are wrong with your painting. We do homework and then the teacher puts them up for all to see and comment on. But I mean, he can just take his laser and darken something that's too light or pull something forward that's too far back. And I mean, it's amazingly helpful, that level of criticism.
Wow.
And there are some artists that when you have a class in a studio and a teacher comes over and wants to do something like that, some teachers will say, may I, and pick up a brush and show. Some students will not allow a teacher to do that.
Is that the point of teaching?
Yes. I was in a class at the Corcoran once, and the regular teacher wasn't there. It was a substitute teacher who walked up to this woman and was trying to explain something to her and said, let me see, and picked up the brush and did something. The woman picked up the canvas from the easel and threw it in the trash.
How does she feel about it?
I was like, honey, you're not that good. Trust me.
Do you like online instruction maybe better than the in-person instruction?
I do. Yeah. I do. Yeah. It's much more focused.
Interesting. Oh, see, maybe that speaks to your, you know, incredibly high professional standards. But I realized Gene and I got met, a few weeks ago at Martin's?
There was some alcohol involved.
Not as much as some of the people around us, but there was.
That's right.
Listen to you talk to me about your painting. And I was talking to Brian later about it. And I said, unlike, I don't know, you know, pre-pandemic, when you would talk about your painting, you talk about instruction, and it was a little tortured. the way it is with many of our authors who talk about the writing process. The last time I saw you, you were talking about painting, your entire body language was, this is great.
Oh, interesting. This is
wonderful. Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. Do you feel that? Do you feel different?
There's good days and there's bad days. I mean, I guess it's like everything, you know. But yeah, I've been doing well, I think. I can honestly say that.
Excellent. Are there any new technological aspects you'd like to share with us?
Well, there is one. Now, I don't use this in class. I do this on my own. But in class, we do art history as well as studio work. In class, we were studying color field painting, which is, for example, Mark Rothko. Just big blocks of color, very few shapes, nothing figurative, everything abstract. And Kenneth Nolan, Mark Rothko, others, it just reduced the painting to very few colors and very few shapes. So I thought, I got this program called Procreate, which is like Adobe Photoshop, but for me, much, much easier. And I took pictures of some of the paintings that I really like, not by color field painters, but by more traditional painters like Cezanne, Manet, Hopper, Vuillard. I took pictures of some of my favorite of their paintings, and I reduced them with Procreate to color field paintings. I just kept the three main colors. I eliminated a lot of details, a lot of shapes, and was left with these abstract paintings, but using their palette, their colors. And some of them, I mean, I haven't done anything with them. They're all on my iPad. But some of them I used as a basis for my own painting. I thought, okay, let me start with this Cezanne landscape that's been boiled down to a big green hump and a black cone and a beige road. And let me see where I go from there. So that's been fun.
And Jean did share some of it with me. It is spectacular. It's really very spectacular. And I sent her a few pictures of things and she immediately, you know, like some stupid trees that I'd taken a picture of. And she sends it back to me in seconds. And it was boiled down, my bad word, to its essence. It was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. It's a little AI-ish to me.
That'll be $1,200 for that.
I'll Venmo you. I'll Venmo you. Okay, but David, this makes me think, is anybody at The Athletic in your world experimenting with AI to write stories? It's being done.
Well, yes, it is. We've talked about that some, haven't we? Not that I know of at our spot, but that doesn't
know.
But I'm not, you know, privy to everything that everyone's doing. You know, we certainly are working graphically on some things that are different and new. But in terms of the actual writing, I don't know. I mean, part of our charm, I guess, is that we, you know, it's a writer's shop. So it's people who have had some success in this industry over some time. And they kind of like that and let us kind of keep our voices. But it's inevitable. I don't doubt it that you will have people using technology to kind of create stories, create scenarios through which writing can kind of be woven through and create new and different things.
Yeah. Claude, radio, what's going on?
Yeah. So apparently there's some like software, some new software in the last year, maybe 2 years, where they can take a vocal sample of someone, write out a script, like just one or two sentences of a voice. They can write an entire script out and then the computer will sound like this person doing whatever the script says on the radio. So you can take a generic music station, get someone's voice. And then just type out, hey, that was this person on this. It's your Tuesday. And here's the next song. And this and no one's saying it. It's the computer. They just took a vocal sample.
Oh, my God.
That's weird. And bad news for radio DJs.
I mean, and also think of the fake celebrity endorsements people will do. Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is Brad Pitt. You know, this is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is Bono.
Okay, but David, think about this. Mm-hmm. It's a you know, early in this whatever the playoffs game somewhere, and you don't want to go. And one of your rock star young people who knows how to do this stuff just slams a few things together, calls Claude for consultation. The next thing you know.
Wouldn't be for me. I get it. It's coming. It's just not for me. I think it's going to be much more usable in the creative space with people kind of coming up with, and actually I think can coming up with very interesting things and very interesting stories, kind of using algorithms and things like that. I mean, I could definitely see that happening very soon, but in terms of what people in news do, I don't know. I mean, I'm not smart enough to know. I'm sure there's an application that I haven't thought of.
We'll see. Okay, Gene, you must remember from back in the day when you joined us at Chatter the Restaurant, which is kind of not no longer.
Yeah.
And my dining room. Moby Dick has a, you know, dear, violently hated place on this show. So
we really doesn't like Moby Dick.
Moby Dick. So Sunday New York Times book section, whatever it's called. I should know this because I steal from it all the time. And they have their thing called Buy the Book where they ask.
Read it every week.
Give them, yep. Right? Yeah. And it's now it's heavily curated. Nobody's sincere on this and that, whatever.
But anybody's got like 50,000 books on their night table, which they can't possibly have.
And there are always these incredibly high level, complex, painful books, which again, nobody reads. So the one a few weeks ago was Frances Mays, who wrote Under the Tuscan Sun, among other things. And they ask her, you know, one of the typical questions, what books are you embarrassed not to have read yet? And she answers, I am assured that I will love Moby Dick if I just give myself another chance. The follow-up question was, what do you plan to read next? And her answer, which was in the form of a question, was Moby Dick? Not yet. The campaign continues.
Right.
All right. Is there any book, David, Claude, Gene, that you were embarrassed you haven't read?
Oh, God.
Oh, so, plenty.
Yeah. I mean, name me the book. If you name the book, the chances are very high I haven't read it. Mm-hmm. The classic book.
Ooh,
yeah. I'm terrible. I'm awfully...
I have never read The Old Man in the Sea. I mean, I was totally into F. Scott Fitzgerald and poo-pooed Hemingway. Now, I've come around and poo-poo F. Scott Fitzgerald and much on, but I've never read The Old Man in the Sea. That's just one example of many.
Oh, but you can read it in 3 minutes. That's why you love Hemingway.
Right? That's right.
Have either of you read Don Quixote?
Well, the actual book?
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen and read Man of La Mancha so many times. I mean, I don't know if that qualifies or not. But
watching the musical as an usher at the National Theater.
This was college production of Man of La Mancha. I had to write a review of when I was in school.
Okay. All right. Segment B, in honor of Halloween coming up. Horror stories, spooky stories, etc. And it's the easiest thing in the world to Google. What are the top 10 horror stories, spooky stories, or whatever? All the sort of outlets out there doing this, obviously, 2 weeks in advance of Halloween. I was personally a little disappointed in some of these lists and surprised by some of them. But let's do David first and then Gene, because it's alphabetical. David, as a kid, did you read anything that you found really, really scary or terrifying, or did you stay away from it completely?
I didn't like that type of, you know, this book is designed to scare you. I didn't mind books that wound up scaring me, but that wasn't really their intent. Uh-huh. And someone on one of those dreadful lists that you talked about had mentioned the Shirley Jackson novel that I hadn't read, but I have read The Lottery, which scared the crap out of me.
why did it scare the crap out of you?
Well, because of the kind of matter of factness of death and deciding that some people weren't, you know, that there was not going to be any discussion or debate about it. We had a lottery, you lost, you die. That's it. You know, and so that kind of randomness was frightening to me.
Uh-huh. Okay. Jean?
So I was thinking about scary stories. And I read a lot more when I was younger, and I thought there must be something about aging that just want to stay away. But I remember my brother giving me a book of H.P. Lovecraft stories. This is not the rock band. This is the writer. And they are truly scary. There is one that sticks with me. I could practically recite it word for word, called Rats in the Walls.
Nice.
See? So that one will keep you awake. But I also was thinking about contemporary ones, and I read Colson Whitehead's Zone One.
Oh, good one.
Many horror fans detest it because it's also literary fiction, but first of all, I like him because he reinvents himself with every book. They're never the same as the one before. And I really liked that book. And the other one that really, really captivated me was Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. I mean, the minute you enter that book, you're like in this shadow land, and there are voices and apparitions and people, and it takes you a while to figure out, my God, I'm in a graveyard, and there's human voices and there's ghost voices and who's who. And then there's Abraham Lincoln.
And given the tragedy of everything in his life, let's just stop with Mary. Very believable.
Very believable.
Call them ghosts, call them apparitions, call them whatever. But I thought the potential reality of that one made it really scary.
Agree.
Yeah. I think I've talked about this in the show before. When we were little, our father, God bless him, used to read to us a lot. And he read to us The Monkey's Paw, which was terrifying.
Yes.
Absolutely terrifying. And I remember once or twice, I'd have sleepovers with some of my little gal pals and slumber parties, whatever. And he'd pull that sucker out, and there was nothing I could do about it. And I thought, like, you know, today's standards, there probably would have been neighbors coming to talk to us about that. And then as an adult, I remember, well, quasi adult, but I remember late teens, maybe reading Helter Skelter.
Oh yeah. Oh,
well, sure. Yeah.
Holy,
I read that. I did. Yeah. See, I don't think of that as a scary book, but it was very, yes, it was
very scary.
Yes. Yes.
And then, you know, it all depends on your definition of the word. So many of these lists, the word ghost was used kind of in the context of Halloween, so you think scary, but then you kept talking about beloved.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, not scary, tragic, sad, but, you know, and I also thought of that. That's just, people have voices when they have deep trauma in their lives. They, you know, the voices are part of their dealing with it. So I didn't see, I was surprised how many lists that showed up on.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
my mom was very well read, so I would go and read her books when I was little, when I was a teenager, and I read In Cold Blood when I was like 13.
Oh,
I was just like, oh my God. Wow.
Yeah,
I think maybe that's a scary book.
That was scary. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think maybe the first time my parents left me home alone, all the other sisters were gone. Sisters, used loosely. and I read that book and I was in the house by myself. I'm not kidding. I was locking doors and windows. I might have been hammering nails in the windows to make sure nobody could open the window. that's a good one, David. That was terrible. Yeah.
It's one that's literary. It's not just, you know, genre thing.
It was scary, but it was a book. It was I liked the book too, you know.
Very well written. Okay. It's 21 after I see Mark Leibovich's name.
Wait. There should be a picture. Hold on. Can you hear me?
We can hear that great voice.
Starting video.
Really trying to decide if he's going to stick around.
Here I am.
Did
I mute myself? I didn't mute myself.
No, you're good.
Glad I didn't share it. Hi, guys. I actually was just turning around to look at books in case you asked me the same question. Terrible at remembering, you know, what books I liked, what movies I liked, all that kind of stuff. But great to be here, guys.
Great to see you. Thank you for joining us.
Good to see you.
I know I have great, just David and Gene, I think we all worked on the 15th Street Washington Post. I don't know if I overlapped with you, David, but I know I always associate you with the Post, which high compliment. And then I came to the Post I was there for about 10 years, but I think it might have been.
When were you there?
97 to.
Oh, I just left. We just missed each other.
We just missed each other.
Yeah.
Anyway, hi, Jeannie.
Mark worked in Investigative, which had the poor fortune of adjoining sports. Especially the row of columnists that included Kornheiser and Wilbon. But I will say Mark was such a good sport. He was one of the few people on the investigative staff who wasn't always shushing us.
I would never have been a shusher.
I know you wouldn't have.
But no, Russ wasn't a shusher. Leon Dash didn't shush. He was happy to see it.
It's right. Such a bad honor not to shush. But I was actually farther away. I actually sat closer to what, for some reason, at the Washington Post, they called the financial section, but everywhere else is the business section. Anyway, Good to be here.
Good to see you. So what is, so it was 1150 15th Street, right? Washington, yep. D20071.
Yes, it was.
What is in that building? Place. Do any of you three Washington Posties know what's in that building now?
There's some shishi restaurants in there now.
I can't even look at the building. I drive past it. I will not look at it. I can't look at it.
This and drive by.
I can't look at it because that's not, it's where, God, everything happened because of that building. And I can't look at whatever it is now.
Exactly. Yeah. Newsroom should not be that fancy.
No, right. Back in the day, and this is a long time ago, when we didn't have all this online interweb stuff, right? And you worked for somebody, maybe a member of Congress, maybe someone worked in an agency. And because of whatever, you knew there was going to be some devastating story that you really didn't want to read and have to explain to your boss. It was not unusual for some desperate soul to be down at 1150 15th Street, zip code 20071, and wait for the first print edition. Because I'm pretty sure the Washington Post and Stanley put the first print copies in its own boxes in front on the street.
Yeah.
And the sad soul would be down there waiting for it desperately to be put in the box.
They put the finals in the street boxes. The first edition was going out to Rehoboth.
Right, right.
And, Warrington and all that. Right. But you could still stand like a poor child at the front door and beg someone to bring you the cap edition, which
they did.
Which, there's an inside part of this, too, which is that when some people, i.e. me and my first front page story, I waited till like 11:30 to actually stand downstairs waiting for that drop to happen also. And I would just pick up my first copy. It was very thrilling. However, we should say as a public service that if there are any people working on the Hill or at the Pentagon or wherever now, this is no longer operational. Like, there's no reason for you to stand downstairs anywhere.
I don't even know where they print the papers now, but it's not downtown. So.
Hey, Mark, I want to ask about your first front page story, but I swear to God, there was a time in which somebody I knew, close to me by blood, would buy up a lot of print copies thinking I could just delay the inevitable as long as possible. Swear to God, going around to the neighborhood where somebody lived to grab up those copies so that person
could
just put off the pain as long as possible. Mark, what was your first front page story in the Washington Post?
Oh, man. It was something about, it was a breaking news thing about like some kind of stock crash. Remember, stocks in the late 90s used to crash like a few hundred points. Mm-hmm. And, I was kind of like in the business section. And yeah, it felt like earth shattering. But no, there was my name on the front page. That really meant something.
Do you still have it? Is it on your shelf there somewhere?
No, but what was interesting, and this is sort of a window into, I don't know what it's a window into, but I had a bunch of front page stories my first few years at the Post. And I grew up in the suburbs of Boston in Massachusetts. And my, the Washington Post wire service would run in like the Boston Globe and a lot of the sort of non New York Times, Wall Street Journal papers, a lot of the regional papers. And I'd have like these big Sunday front page stories, but my parents really only got excited when like 1/4 of some story was picked up on page A32 of Boston Globe. Said, wow, you made the Globe. It goes to the parochialism of like Boston. But it was like, wow, you finally amounted to something. You're in the local paper. And actually, there are analogous stories of people like in other, like when their parents see something in, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette or the Chicago, whatever. I mean, it happens all over the country. So, but that was when my parents first started to notice that, things were going pretty well.
Maybe it's a real job. Okay. So last time we had you in person, which was at Chatter the Restaurant, God rest its soul. And we had you talking about the big game. You were still at the New York Times at the time. Now you're at the Atlantic after how many years at the New York Times?
17.
17. That's a long time. Then you switch to the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. How has your life changed?
You know, It's been a weird year. It's actually been a really weird 3 years. I wasn't expecting to leave the Times. I really started to hate politics when Trump started winning in 2016. I needed a break. That's why I wrote the NFL book. And then, you know, there was that, then the pandemic happened and 2020 was brutal. And I stopped working for the Times Magazine and I went back to work at the Washington Bureau. I became much more interested in actually the NBA. I was thinking I wanted to write a book about the NBA, but then my agent and
David, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting because David is just rocking back in his chair going, God rest him. God rest his soul.
Go, wait, which one? the NBA or me?
No. You.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. No, I'd love NBA is great from the outside. David probably has a 180 degree different perspective, but I was watching it really closely and it struck me as a fascinating lead. But anyway, I was sitting at home and I'd always been a newsroom guy. I'd always loved being in newsrooms. I had friends. I love the energy of newsrooms. And all of a sudden, you know, we're working from home and this was not good for me. But after a while, I became kind of a homebody and I kind of became an indoor cat for the first time in my career. I've always been kind of an outdoor cat and like you can travel and you can go out and you can wander and you can waste time and you can go out after work and stuff. And, you know, I kind of missed magazine writing and I liked The Atlantic and I needed a change. And I figure, you know, if you're under 65, you should err on the side of discomfort in your career.
Yeah,
I think
agree.
You know, I keep moving that age up. So as I get, you know, within a few years of it, I might move it up to 70. But, you know, I just figured I'd try something new. And so far, so good.
Yeah. Is Jeffrey Goldberg still there, right? The Atlantic?
He is. Yeah. He's the guy who hired me. I mean, I we've been sort of playing footsie, but not in a serious way. I mean, he's sort of a guy about town. And it just sort of happened. And kind of there was this confluence of, I wasn't having a lot of fun at the Times. That looked more fun. I had a book coming out. I also, you know, as a political reporter, which is basically what I am, it became very hard to kind of play it straight in a New York Times kind of way. I mean, God bless the New York Times. And, you know, they've let me get away with a lot of kind of voicey point of view kind of stuff over the years. But, you know, sky is green stuff. I mean, what's happening in your former party, Tory? I don't know if it's your former party or what, but the Trump years are hard to play straight. And I wanted an opportunity to, you know, not so much use more point of view, but actually to sort of talk in a more expansive way, which I think a magazine format has been helpful.
Here's my Jeffrey Goldberg story, because this shows us an opportunity to tell stories. Pretty sure. He is the guy that he was at New York at the New Yorker, and David Bradley, who's an icon in this bizarre world, really wanted him. And Jeffrey just kept saying, nope, I'm, you know, got the family, got this, the rabbit, somewhere in New York, near New York, and got little kids, and they're going to start riding horses soon, and this and that, whatever. David Bradley sent two ponies to the front door of Jeffrey Goldberg's house to convince him that he and his family could be very happy working in Washington, D.C. for the Atlantic.
And now that's sort of a famous story. There's an actually addendum to that, which is that David Remnick called Jeff after this and said, what, you want a fucking horse? I'll get you a fucking horse. Am I allowed to swear on this thing? Sorry, if you're not, I'm correct.
As somebody who had horses,
and now you are.
Brian, God bless him, has just walked in, knows that would be the worst mistake any business organization would ever make. It will cost you more than anything you've ever done. David, biggest change from day to day, what you did, the Washington Post and the Athletic, cultural change.
Well, as Mark said, if you're used to coming into a newsroom every day, as I was for 9 years, I mean, that kind of becomes your world and you become very comfortable in that world. And the noise and the kind of things that would drive a lot of other people to distraction are like catnip for you. Like, you love it. Like, you can't even imagine not having it, right? Like, you just know, you're just sitting there waiting for that phone. You're just looking at the phone. It's got to ring in the next 12 minutes or I'm screwed. And inevitably it always rang with like 37 seconds left before deadline, and you pick it up and you do the best you can. But if you don't, you gotta love that. If you don't love it, then this is not the job for you, right? That being gone, working in a room by myself is really weird for me. It's very odd and disconcerting, but you do it because you have to do it, but it's weird.
Okay, so I swear to God, Mark, we're going to talk so much about the book, which is fantastic. But Gene, you and I have talked about this some. I always thought I worked, you know, 1,000 years ago, I worked for 2-3 years at the Washington Star, greatest place in the world, better on a day-by-day basis than the Washington Post. But there was the conventional term or the current term is crowdsourcing. David, mm-hmm. your description of the newsroom. And Gene, you and I have talked about this. There's a crowdsourcing effect. You think you're just waiting for the first phone call. But in the meantime, David, you're asking, so what about this? What about that? Should I be doing this? And there is this cumulative crowdsourcing effect from the physical layout of a newsroom, which I found really useful and helpful and very efficient. But Gene, what did you love about it?
Well, I loved everything that Mark and David have said. I mean, I loved going into the newsroom, but I was just thinking about the sort of sidebar conversations right. that would take place when you're in between deadlines or when there's a lull in the day. And for some reason, there was this editor's pod, David, you know where it was, me and Tracy and Burko. And reporters or columnists would come by and start talking. And then it's like a magnet, you know, other reporters would come up. And one day we got started talking about pitchers, about who was the best pitcher. And this Wilbon would make this argument, and Kornheiser would make this argument, and Burko would make this argument. And on and on and on it went until approaching the crowd was Shirley Povich, who had seen Walter Johnson pitch.
Literally.
And who weighed literally. In.
Yeah.
And the court rested. We adjourned after Walter Johnson's name was brought up. But that's just one example.
Shirley would stop all conversations because he'd say something like, you know, I was talking to Babe Ruth one day and he said, that's the end of that.
The night of the long count.
That's so great. Bush 41 used to have this wonderful thing. He would tolerate a lot of just incredibly sweet guy. And he would tolerate a lot. And then he would kind of end it with, if you're so smart, why are you not president? Yeah, just kind of stopping.
That's a good line from him. That's good.
Okay, Mark. I have told many, many, many people that this is the first political book, and I use that word carefully because I think it's much more than that. I've written a long time because I, you know, political memoirs, and I can't believe how many you had to read as part of writing this book.
Oh, yeah. The footnotes.
Oh my God. God bless you. That's a labor of love. I just don't read them. I don't like them. All sorts of things. There just hasn't been much done in a long time that's been useful. This book is wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. It's great. When we had you on the show to talk about the big game, the book about the NFL, you said you wanted to write about the NFL because you were sick of politics or tired of politics. You wanted to try something else. But Trump had a way of inserting himself into that time and into that book. What caused you, unlike many of your peers who are smart and talented, and I get this, to approach not Donald Trump head on, but as I've come to call them, the enabling class?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, you couldn't really ask any book that was set from 2016 to 2018, which is what the big game was. Right. Trump was inescapable, especially since it was largely about the owners class and about the, you know, all these kind of guys who run the league, and they're deeply flawed and often corrupt and horrific individuals. And, you know, about half of them were Trump people or, you know, many of them gave money to Trump, you know, Kraft, Jerry Jones. I mean, they go down the list. I mean, he kept and you know, that was during the time when he was going after Colin Kaepernick and the league, and they were poor and, you know, like the Republican senators in this current book or congressmen and much of the Republican Party, the NFL owners kind of cowered to Donald Trump. And, you know, he was in a position to, they thought, really, you know, do damage to them. Whereas Kevin McCarthy, Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, even like Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, this whole crew, I mean, that is the enabling class. I mean, I wanted to focus. I mean, I really find Trump himself boring. I didn't want to read another book about the White House intrigue. I didn't want to read another book trying to understand Trump supporters in Ohio or Pennsylvania or whatever. I didn't want to read another book just on the intrigue. I thought that an undertold story of all this was that this was not possible without the almost near unanimous consent of the Republican Party and the leadership or putative leadership of the Republican Party. Because, you know, if there were 20 Liz Cheneys, they could have shut this down. There would be a counter argument. There would be a, there would be a debate inside the Republican Party. Now it's just a cult of personality. And I wanted to sort of give readers a sense of what that looked like in the sort of day-to-day corruption of these individuals.
Yeah, I was tempted as I was reading the book and listening to the book, I was tempted to just go, okay, this is so easy for you to hit the ball out of the park. Just anecdote after story. But the blurbs on the back of the book, thank you for serving, the best blurbs ever, because they are verbatim quotes from some of the enablers that you feature in the book. Okay, let's just start with this one. And he's a bit of a tragic mixed guy, Mitt Romney. Oh, everybody gets the joke. Tell us about that.
So there's this expression in Washington, and you've probably heard it or used it before. I mean, getting the joke, meaning you sort of know, everyone knows what this is about. We can't say it publicly, but everyone here in the Republican Party, my colleagues in the Senate, if you're Mitt Romney talking, knows that the joke is that this guy, Donald Trump, is basically incompetent. He is malignant. He doesn't know what he's doing. He is mentally ill. I mean, any number of things that people will say privately, we all get the joke. But the joke is also we have to deal with it. We have to make certain concessions. We have to accommodate it. Well, we don't have to, but many people choose to accommodate it and just sort of try to go along, get along. And if you don't want to be reelected, I think this is this on the back of this? This is a, quote number two from Lindsey Graham. If you don't want to be reelected, you're in the wrong business. So he keeps saying that, meaning, you know, I don't care what's right and wrong. I don't care how horrific the things that Donald Trump are doing or saying are. We want to be reelected. That's the joke in Lindsey Graham's telling of it. So, yeah, the joke is, I think, a very pernicious thing, and it's been used in a lot of contexts. But in this one, it was very, very dispiriting to have to listen to.
No kidding. Okay, let's go back. Let's go David first, then Gene. Going back to 2015, whenever it was, when Donald Trump first raised his hand and said, oh, what a joke, I'm going to run for president. Did you pay any, and it's a legitimate question, real question, did you pay any attention? Did you think anything of it? Did you take it at all seriously?
Yes.
You did? Why? Because most people didn't, David.
Because rich people get attention. Rich people can create the apparatus by which they get attention, and they can control media in a way that most people can't. And whatever you think of Donald Trump's intellect, he's good on TV, or he was good on TV. Yeah. So I took it seriously. Now, I didn't think he'd get the nomination, but I thought this guy's it's not going to be a disaster. He's going to do well, because a lot of people are going to just say, oh, that's the guy from TV. I like him.
It's the guy from Friends. Gene, did you take him seriously, not pay attention? Because
never took it seriously. I had never watched The Apprentice, so I never understood that whole attraction that people found and that his leadership style was so strong. Hoped he'd come down the escalator and fall flat on his big fanny. I just never thought he'd get very far.
Right. I remember when he first announced, totally knew that it was a total, he was just trying to pump up his ratings, his, you know, whatever, because it was a marketing thing. But I kept saying to my Republican friends at the time, don't discount this guy. And it was less because of his ability to control the media, David. For me, it was more he could withstand the intensity of what the interweb brings on people now, unlike a lot of the people he's running against. And, you know, then he gets the nomination. And I wasn't that surprised. And I would say to all my Democratic friends, you better take this guy seriously because we're in a different era now. Right. And then I was working for a German company at the time, and we'd be talking about this. And I'd say, but, you know, here's the good thing. And here's where I was fabulously wrong. I'd say, if by, you know, some chance he becomes president, don't worry. So don't worry, because the office of the presidency has this way of bringing people between the guardrails. And I want to come to you on this front, you know, back in between the guardrails. And it just, the way the system is, it causes them to have to abide by our constitution and systems that have been in place for a long time, those kinds of things. And my German friends, God bless them, would look at me and go, don't ever underestimate what one guy can do.
Mm-hmm. How do they know?
Any examples?
Yeah. What are you, Germany? Anyway, yeah.
But that's, you know, the guardrails that came up in the book. Thank you for your servitude, Mark.
Yeah.
Talk about that. People assumed for a while he'd stay within the guardrails, right?
I did. I mean, I kind of thought, you know, I never paid much attention to him. Never watched The Apprentice, never read part of the deal. I mean, I always thought he was like, okay, some kind of cartoonish kind of guy. I remember watching him like on Tim Russert. And I mean, he would do interviews and he was kind of compelling. He had this very kind of authoritative way of speaking. I know people listened to him. And, you know, there is a world in which someone who had a reasonable and somewhat humble approach to life, who was like that, who didn't have an ideology, who just was like pure celebrity, could actually govern in a way that was, you know, fairly effective. Like, I'd stayed at a few Trump hotels and service was always good. You know, I mean, it's like, okay, this is a business that seems to maybe run fairly well. Right. So I thought that the office, the norms, the Washington, the sort of the way this always would prevail. I really did. I think the presidency basically changes everyone. It's a very humbling thing for people. But I think in his case, it was actually a job that matched the megalomania that he has. I mean, I think it worked in the absolute opposite direction. I mean, I remember seeing George W. Bush, you know, when the planes at the towers, Andy Card, you know, whispers to him, he had this sort of look on his face. He just sort of looked different, just like he did sort of after he became president. And remember Obama, I was in Chicago when he went out to Grant Park and was then his first public appearance as president. He had this like, whoa, this is like, there's like a graininess between, I mean, he had this different look in his eye and he looks like he's aged 10 years in the last 2 hours in a weird way. Trump actually had this sort of shell-shocked look on the night of the election in 16 also. I remember I watched the video this closely because there was a chapter on the book and I thought, okay, well, maybe he'll kind of be scared straight here and, you know, he's going to have maybe a somewhat gracious phone call and they'll sort of keep him in check. And then, like, I remember a couple of days later, you know, Michael Flynn is the national security advisor and Ivanka and Jared are made senior White House. And it's like, uh-oh, this could be bad. You know, he's a deeply, 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 I would say pathological kind of guy. And I don't think the office changed him for the better necessarily. And, you know, here we are now.
Okay. Someone who's not gotten better over the years, Lindsey Graham. I mean, I'm just piling on. And Mark, I cannot believe we never do books like this. It makes me so happy. Talk about Lindsey Graham. And I'll set it up by this. 1,000 years ago, John McCain, senator, whatever, this guy, Lindsey Graham, comes up from South Carolina. And it, you know, one of the many things in which John McCain and I disagreed, he discovers this guy, Lindsey Graham, and he literally would take him by the arm when Lindsey Graham first came to Congress and would walk him around and introduce him to people, introduce him to other members of Congress, yeah. key staffers. Go up to the Senate press gallery and go, you got to meet this guy before Washington ruins him. He's great. He's great. And I just kept looking and going, I'm missing the great here. You know, and right. As long as I keep thinking of guardrails, because that's such a big part of this book. Yeah. As long as John McCain was alive and well, he could, you know, Lindsey just looked at John. What are you doing? Okay, yeah. I'll do that. Right. And then when John McCain starts to get sick, Lindsey starts to go this way. But as I said, you know, some of the so-called good people in this book, the John McCain's, the Mitt Romney's, Liz Cheney's, the world, some of them were a little flawed. And it's easy for me to say, but I think the John McCain relationship could have affected more of a more positive, constructive response on Lindsey Graham. But talk about Lindsey Graham and all of this. If you don't want to be reelected, you're in the wrong business.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham, I mean, look, he's a comedian in his own way. He's a kind of a born sidekick. He would always say, back when McCain was alive, you know, I like alpha dogs. You know, I was like the mascot in the little bar in South Carolina that my parents owned. And you grew up really poor and kind of they lived and behind the bar and they kind of shared the bathroom with the bar. It was like a really weird upbringing, but he just followed his dad around. He was the mascot. And it was the same kind of model when he came to the House, eventually the Senate, where he was basically a derivative character of John McCain. He kind of lived in his shadow. He was like the Robin to, you know, John McCain's Batman. Something. And You know, Lindsay told me, I mean, he said, you know, I like to be at the dice table. And John McCain is like a thrill seeker, and he goes into war zones and he goes into these really tense negotiations in the Senate, the House, or the White House, or whatever. And I love being at the dice table. I like sort of the thrill that he gives me, and he's, cause he's always in the middle of things. And then, you know, when McCain started getting sick, it was weird because he replaced him with Trump, and Trump is ultimate alpha dog in the Republican Party. And he gets a real, real charge out of being on the golf course and people in the Senate coming up to him saying, hey, can you get a message to the president? Maybe get a birthday call to my, you know, wife or something like that. And this is, I mean, again, it's a little twisted, but this is where he gets like his emotional sustenance. And unlike pretty much anyone else in the U.S. Senate now, one of his colleagues told me this, I mean, Lindsey Graham needs to be a U.S. senator. He cannot not get reelected. He doesn't have a family, doesn't really have any hobbies. He just sort of needs to be in the shot, in the golf course, on the golf course, on Air Force One. You know, he just needs to have the president calling. I mean, it's a weird, weird kind of warped extreme.
And it's not for some, you know, deep. I think it comes through in the book. For so many of these people, they had to do whatever they could to suck up to Trump so they could get reelected. And yeah. So many of these people, it's not some deep meaning. It's because this is the only thing they know what, you know, that's the only thing they can do.
Right.
If you take 535 members of Congress, none of us would hire 20 of them to run a bake sale. This is what they do. This is all they can do. And so they would do anything to enable this guy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's sort of interesting because I'm kind of, I mean, I would 10 years ago, I would have described myself as a cynic. Like I'm kind of a political reporter's. I mean, look, I come to the cynicism, honestly, as of a few years ago, right? In a weird way, what I've seen in people over the last 5 or 6 years has made me more idealistic because I've seen what cynicism looks like from the other side. And what I mean by that is I would often ask the Lindsey Grahams and the Kevin McCarthys and even Trump once when I interviewed him like early on during the first campaign, you know, how do you want to be remembered? Are you worried about like the verdict of history? Like you're saying all this stuff. And they almost to a person would just scoff. They would look at me like I had two heads. And McCarthy used to say, yeah, like Jeff Flake, you know, he's this very principled conservative, couldn't stand Trump. You know, and which made it really hard to stay in the Senate. And he wound up not running for Senate. And he was bullied and abused by, you know, pretty much all of his former colleagues and Trump and everything. He said, well, where's the Jeff Flake statue in the Senate? Like, no one cares anymore. And I don't care about being remembered because I want to be Speaker of the House. This is McCarthy talking. And if I can get that job, you know, I don't care if it goes, if I last one term or not, I'll be a former speaker the rest of my life. And maybe I'll get the Bakersfield, California airport named after me. You know, Graham, same thing. He would just say, don't care. I don't care. And there's this kind of nihilism, like there's no historical, you know, investment we're making here. We're not playing for history. We're playing for the next election, the next news cycle, the next, you know, pat on the head from Donald Trump. It was really, really dispiriting to have these conversations, but really funny. It was, I try to be funny about it because you can get away with a lot of stuff. You can make people laugh. And, you know, I think there was a lot of ridicule left on the table during these years that I needed to sort of go back and really work and sort of, you know, hopefully maybe not entertain people with, but at least, you know, put it on the record.
Mark, well, that is one of the things that I loved about the book and why I just flew right through it, because I got your humor. I got your voice. It made it so easy to read. And it also, maybe it was because of your sort of oversaturation with politics, I thought that you were such a great risk taker with your questions. Your questions could be quite thorny. And right. Then you'd sort of like, with all due respect, but it reminded me of the great Lenny Bruce, who used to say horrible, horrible things to people and then say, I hope I'm not out of line. That's what he reminded me of. And they responded. They weren't insulted by it.
Well, you know, there's like a liberation that goes with like losing all respect for certain people, which unfortunately these years have allowed me to do. And on the other hand, you know, shamelessness is a superpower on the other end too. And, you know, Trump has sort of taught a lot of people the lessons of shamelessness in ways that have not been for the better for our world.
It seemed like you had a lot of fun. To Gene's point, it's just spectacularly fun to read, to listen to. And it's funny, you know, deeply tragic in many ways because of what it represents, but yeah, really funny. And sometimes I was thinking to myself, I'm a huge fan of Chris Buckley, who's one of the great satirists.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I started bordering on, oh, great satire. I was like, no, this is for real.
Yeah.
And so much the questions you ask these people in their own words, they said these things that were so damning. So incredibly damning. Yeah. Do you feel like you need to take a shower sometimes? You'd be talking to them and interviewing about this stuff and go, oh, I really need a shower.
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit. I mean, what's interesting, and actually sort of take it back to the original question. I mean, when during the pandemic, I was really under the gun for the book deadline. I mean, I like didn't have a lot of time. I had like 3 months to do like the last sort of second half of the book, and a lot was happening, and the insurrection happened, and the pandemic, I mean, just a lot happened. And so I'd get up at 7 a.m. and probably write till about maybe 11:30. And, you know, I didn't like waking up. I mean, I would have done that. That was a lot easier when I was 30 than, you know, I'm in my 50s now. But it was really fun writing. It was like, okay, I can write whatever I want here because it's my book. I mean, it's got to be accurate. It's got to be, you know, you got to be fair and all. But and then, you know, I'd have my day job at the New York Times starting, you know, around 11 or so till the rest of the day. And just the writing I would do in the first part of the day was so much more enjoyable than in the second part. And that actually helped me sort of see more clearly how I wanted to spend the next couple of decades, if, you know, God willing, I'm healthy to sort of continue to do this. But yeah, no, it was a real challenge to make this fun, because I think it's an ongoing, very depressing story, and it only becomes more so. And, you know, I keep waiting for the fever to break. But it's a pretty scary time.
May I ask you about that? Because my friend Charlie Pierce, who writes for Esquire, often refers to the prion disease that's afflicted the Republican Party in the last 45 years. And I mean, I was a kid, but I remember 1974, and I remember Barry Goldwater leading a bunch of Republican senators to the White House and saying, we're done with you. You're out. That's it. We can't abide by this anymore. Right. Yep. And that wasn't 300 years ago. Like, so what's happened?
You know, you're right. I mean, what people miss about Nixon is there are a couple of key differences. I mean, Barry Goldwater, you know, extremely conservative, you know, not good on a lot of very sort of
right.
But, you know, he was ultimately a grown up, as was the House and the Republican House. I forgot their names.
Rhodes, right? Rhodes of Arizona.
John Rhodes. And yes, from I think one was from Michigan. The other, I forgot where the other
was. Wasn't it Bob Michael?
Not during Watergate, but yeah, it was around then. Anyway, but they, you know, they marched up to the White House and said, you know, you're going to lose your support among Republicans. And there were some backbenchers like Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland's father. Charles Hogan was like this kind of like backbencher Republican, pretty, you know, loyal soldier for Nixon. And all of a sudden he said, you know, I don't like this. I'm voting for impeachment. And Nixon said, you know, when I lost Hogan, I knew that like some dominoes could fall. And then Goldwater and everyone came up to the White House. But the other big thing is, you know, Nixon didn't have Fox News, internet. I actually believe that if Nixon had Fox News, if he had Kevin McCarthy, you know, if he had like maybe Barry Goldwater instead of Lindsey Graham, or Kevin McCarthy instead of, you know, whoever else, I mean, it might have been different. But Fox News is, I think, kind of a game changer in this regard. And I also think that Trump is, you know, in some ways more dangerous than Nixon, although who knows what Nixon could have done given his like much higher level of intelligence than Trump has now, if he were around today with Fox, you know, sort of like carrying the flag for him.
Wow. Okay. Topic for another show, which would take forever. I think social media in general, much more powerful than even Fox News.
Could be, absolutely.
More powerful. And yeah, oh, scary. Okay, let's get you out with this for a real question about you and the fabulous book, and then we'll subject you to 60 seconds more.
All right, Brent.
Take off, if you can, your objective journalist hat and look ahead to 2024, beyond, whatever you want. Are you pessimistic or optimistic? And if so, why?
Pessimistic or optimistic? I'm kind of pessimistic. Not that I think that Trump will be president again, although he very well could be. I mean, I think there are two people that are most likely to be president. He's one of them. Because I think it'll either be a Democrat or Republican. I think he's the most likely Republican nominee. And I think Biden's the most likely Democratic nominee, which is depressing also because he's too old, I think. But, you know, I'd still much rather have him than Trump. Look, I think we need more than two major parties, but that's another discussion. I think one of our parties, I mean, I think the Democrats have all kinds of problems, all kinds. I mean, Biden's got all kinds of problems. The country has all kinds of problems. But I think that, you know, the Republicans could very well do quite well in a few weeks in the midterm. And that is going to potentially vindicate, you know, not vindicate tax cuts or be a repudiation of Biden or a repudiation of Democrats or any sort of set of ideas. It will be an endorsement of election denial and the kind of sort of, you know, just truth that corruption of, I mean, the whole, like, you know, Ron DeSantis sending, you know, the Venezuelan refugees up to Martha's Vineyard and, you know, New York and Chicago. I mean, like Washington. I mean, I just think that there's just like this whole set of characters who are perpetrating this whole set of lies and malignancies that could very well be vindicated and probably give Republicans the House. And, you know, I was an extremely nonpartisan person a few years ago, and I'm still nonpartisan, but, you know, I just think that, like, there is now a level of lying and malignancy and basically racism that is baked even more purely into the system of the Republican Party than ever before in ways that I could never have imagined.
And on that happy note.
Oh, man. But it's a fun book. Everyone here.
It is a fun book.
Not to be holding up the book, but I, you know. It's
like, it is. You know. As I was doing my notes, I just kept, you know, saying so much fun. And yeah. I'm careful about using the word, Gene, because it's important. And it really makes clear, you know, there's a great question. Was Trump the symptom or the catalyst? He's both, right?
Right.
But it makes clear, you know, nothing big or important, negative or positive, ever happens with a single person, Hitler notwithstanding. This one, I mean, these people who just rolled over and played dead, and they did because it was in their own best interest. They got to keep these goofy jobs. But it is really fun and funny, and it's spectacularly written. And I'm really glad you did it, Mark. So thank you.
Thanks, Tori.
Okay, Mark Lee, but seriously, the book, Thank You for Your Servitude, is spectacular. What's next? What's the next book?
Being done with this one. No, I'm never again. I've said this now five times. Every time, never again. This is the last one.
That'd be a great title for a book. Being done.
Doneness. I remember, like, you know, we've all sort of been there, and at, you know, just at the end of the day, the story is like, it's fine. You know, maybe you wish this had happened, or this phone call had happened, or this thing had broken, or whatever. And my editor would always say some version of just revel in its doneness. Doneness is a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Done is a great thing. Okay. This show is done. Claude, thank you for making everything happen, my friend. David, Gene McManus, great to see you in person. So great to have Gene back. Mark, thank you. You were there at the beginning. You're here now. We hope you come back again. Everyone should get this book. Thank You for Your Servitude. It's fabulous. Great cover art, too. And then come back in a week, because we have, and this person is a rock star, Candace Cardi Williams, most famous for Queenie, is going to come back. And she's got a great book called People Person, fabulous person. And she'll be in the UK, so it'll be late for her, mm-hmm. on time for us. Thank you, everybody. Love you all.
Bye.
I'll be back.
Bye. Bye, Mark.
Bye. Good seeing you guys.
Guests on Chatter on Books are entitled to be entered into a raffle to win a home version of Chatter on Books, which includes a deck of laminated playing cards, a colorful game board, and an hourglass-style timer. One entry per person. In case of duplicate prizes, ties will be awarded. Must be present to win.